Hello, Podcasting Hall of Famers here, Keith Malley and...
Hemda.
That's right. I'll prove it to you. That's the award, see? All right, everybody, we're about to begin my opening line with the great Mike Lawrence. But first, I have big, big news, exciting information. My new album, album number 15...
Sick, bro.
...is now available, entitled Drip Drip. It's definitely my most personal one yet, and it's weird for me to say this, but I believe it's my best stand-up yet.
I thought it was so great. It's hard for me to say this was your best stand-up, but I was cracking up. I mean, you have 15 albums, so it's hard, but you were in such a weird, dark place, and I love when comedians write from that place, because what you did was you said the terrible things about yourself, and then you completely laughed about it, which is so much fun.
We talk about marriage and divorce. Yours, not mine. This one's actually about you, the listener. No, it's about mine. Dating, being sober, gun control, the Me Too movement, the death of Stephen Hawking, real upbeat stuff. But I think you're going to like it.
I like that you named it Drip Drip because I'm encouraging people to Google Keith Malley and Drip Drip. I mean, you could find it at keithandthegirl.com/album, but I want the SEO of Keith Malley Drip Drip to be the highest thing ever. Because right now, when people look up Keith Malley, what do they find?
Divorce, wife, drunk. I would like it to change as well.
It's funny when Drip Drip is a step up from your Google.
The album's available at keithandthegirl.com/album. In our store, you can also get it from iTunes. Just search for Malley Drip Drip. You can get it from Amazon. Go to keithandthegirl.com/Amazon. Type in Drip Drip. Okay, you know how the internet works. It's available. We hope you pick it up. Thank you. My opening line, Adam Feeling. Fine. Hello and welcome to My Opening Line. I'm Keith and the Girls, Keith Malley.
I'm Hemda.
Very excited. Be subscribed, by the way, to My Opening Line. Don't miss out. I'm looking at Kevin Allison, Bonnie McFarlane, Overwatch's Lucy Pohl, Gilbert Gottfried. These are very exciting shows. We're excited to put them out. Make sure you never miss one. Right or wrong, Hemda?
I agree completely.
All right.
Wouldn't it be great, though, if I didn't agree? I'm like, do you think they should? I don't know. Bonnie's great, but no.
If you disagree, it's something we need to talk about.
True. Yeah, on air.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest from Jeff Ross Presents Roast Battle, the third place winner. Can you imagine? No. We go to the top. Featured on Seth Meyers, Conan, John Oliver's New York stand-up show, Crashing. He's not only so good at these roasts, he won on the fictional show doing a roast on Crashing. Mike Lawrence.
Hey, how's it going?
How you doing? Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Dude, I'm seeing you everywhere.
Yeah.
This is it. Are you saving?
Yeah. A lot.
All right.
Do you have, there's a lot of like, as an artist, you're afraid to walk away from your whatever normal life, a normal paycheck.
Right.
You started at McDonald's.
Yeah.
I believe we met you when you're still open micer, basically.
Yeah, you met me like as it was like, God, there's no non-arrogant way to say it, but as it was starting to happen.
Right.
You know, so I think I did your guys' show first in the summer of 2010. And I think I had just done Montreal New Faces. And Brian, you know, Baldinger had just become my manager. And then he introduced me to you guys.
Yeah, that was incredible. I didn't even know that was 10 years ago that you did Keith and the Girl for the first time. That's
because it was 8.
That's amazing.
That's why. Right.
I didn't mean to be mean. That's just my nerd brain. Like the numbers.
When you go into McDonald's now.
Yeah. Which I did last night. I had a 20-piece by myself.
Okay. That was a test. Shame on you.
Yeah. I agreed. I'm feeling it. Yeah. Why do you think I'm only drinking water and not soda?
You do look hungover, right? And you don't drink.
No, I know. I'm nugged over. Yeah.
Do you go into McDonald's and give them like a little smile to let them know, hey, it does get better?
Yeah, yeah. I was doing Skanks Fest this weekend, there was a McDonald's across the street. I left the venue at like 2 a.m. after judging a naked roast battle.
Mm-hmm. What? By the way, one second. What do we think about them? Does everything have to be a gimmick? What do we think? Like, hey, you do the roast ball, but now you have to be naked. Would you ever do stuff like that? Oh, there's comedy, but they throw shit at you.
It's marketing, you know. It gets, you know, people to want to see something. Right. It's a spectacle.
Were you naked as the judge?
Yep.
Okay, I thought so. Yeah, they're equal opportunity over there. Okay. They're not messing around. Like, if you're going to judge these people about their comedy and them standing up in front of you, you will be naked as well.
Yeah, it's funny, like, you know, like you know, some of, like, the audience, you know, is a little aggressive at times. But then, like, they're, like, the most respectful people in person. And then it's also, you know, like, they had, like, a strict no photography policy for it. And everyone's like, yeah, we get it, bro. You know,
okay. That's cool. That's nice. Yeah.
They don't come up through the crowd when they go on stage, I'm going to assume, right? There's no way.
No, but they are forced to jump into it at the end and surf.
So you see a McDonald's across the street. It's 2 a.m.
And just to be clear, you worked there for 7 years before your comedy career.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'd started comedy while I was working at McDonald's. But yeah, it was funny. I literally was just like, I feel like I deserve this. You know?
Oh my God.
You know what it was that I didn't eat all day because I knew I was judging a naked roast battle.
Like, you're binging in reverse, right?
It was like literally like 2 minutes before we got on stage, I thought to myself, like, because I kind of had to pee, and I was like, man, like, what if I piss my pants while laughing, but there are no pants? Then I'm just pissing. And I was like, yeah. So I used the bathroom, and then I was like super hungry after it, and I was like, I'm gonna do McDonald's. I was like, I deserve this.
Did you actually know that there would be a McDonald's across the street? And
were you counting the time?
Like in the back of your mind, just going yes or no? But I know it's a yes.
You all win. The end.
Yeah, I envisioned it. It was the secret.
You manifested.
Yeah. What? Not what I need. What do I deserve?
Now, not you as a judge, because you're a professional.
Yeah.
But the audience. Mm-hmm. Does the audience seem to go for somebody who's attractive naked or unattractive naked? It has to affect one way or another.
It does not. No. I mean, if anything, like, there's sympathy for the worse the body is, you know? And it's also, it's that thing, like, there's just so much respect, like, oh, you're willing to do this and all of that. Cool. It's like very, it's funny, you know, I when I was coming up, I did the naked, you know, show a bunch. And I know people have different thoughts on that and everything. But people always be like, do you get hard in the green room? What's it like when there's like naked girls in the green room? I'm like, you're respectful. It's fine. Like, you're just performers doing a show.
You know what's funny is I feel like people forget that the people who are going to cross your boundaries are not waiting for you to get naked.
Yeah.
Like, it's not because you're naked that people cross boundaries. It's because they're boundary crossers. It's because they think that your body doesn't really belong to you. They get to make those decisions.
So, with that said, I do know guys that have done this and chubbed up in the bathroom deliberately.
Chubbed up, but they're not trying to touch anybody or make it weird.
I mean, look at my stomach. I've been chubbing up for years.
Oh, you mean lower. I see. Yeah.
Like, I would personally make my nipples hard because otherwise, like, how will anyone tell a joke?
Right. Now, when do you start doing stand-up, let's say, you know, comedy in the McDonald's to see how things are going to work out back in the day? Or do you say, or the first time you really do, you know what I mean? Like, I don't do, when I talk to my dad, it's not until I'm done with the phone call, but I'm like, I just did stand-up because we don't know how to talk to each other. You know, I was just performing. Did you do that first in McDonald's with coworkers?
Yeah, I mean,
or on an actual stage?
Like, my stand-up started, I did slam poetry for years.
Okay.
Before doing stand-up. And the thing was, I didn't want to do stand-up because my mom did, and nothing your parents do is cool.
Right.
Like, I went...
Poetry slams are cool.
Exactly. And so I went to, you know, a few gigs when I was a kid, you know, and I'd see my mom, and it, like, it never, the shows never did anything for me because, you know, I was 8 years old. I loved Ninja Turtles. I didn't want to just watch adults talk. Like, that's what stand-up was to me. Right. And I hear, you know, stories of kids all the time. They're like 7 and they see their first special and they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. That wasn't the case for me.
Did that offend your mom? Because it was her that you were watching talking.
A little bit. Yeah, I think so. We remember we had a confrontation once. You know, she's like, you didn't laugh that much in the crowd. And I was just like, I don't know. I didn't find that funny. And, you know, that really hurt her because, you know, my favorite thing at the time was Beavis and Butthead. And, you know, it's like, look, mom, you're you're good, but you're not Happy Gilmore good.
I know somebody that has a kid. The kid saw her do stand-up. And she tells this embarrassing story about the kid being in third grade. My son did this, blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, all right, I went for it. I let my kid see what I do. Let's see what they think. And the kid was disgusted because the kid goes, I'm in fourth grade.
I mean, I didn't like I said, when I saw my mom, I understand why you take it personally, but I didn't like any stand-up, really. I didn't, I think the first stand-up I really liked was, Patton Oswalt. I watched his,
how old were you?
I must have been, maybe 15 or 16.
This reminds me, we used to do kids' parties for a living, and I'd go sometimes to restaurants, and it would be a five-year-old's birthday, and the adults always looked so confused. They were like, I don't get it. Every time we come here, this kid is so excited. He orders the same meal. He sits there. He talks to the waiters. He has an incredible experience. He's always excited by this restaurant. And I go, yeah, because mommy and daddy are there. They're paying all their attention on you. He orders the one thing. He gets to kind of walk around. Now you're putting 5-year-olds at a table with each other, you'd not even recognizing, like you said, adults talking or even kids sitting at a table talking is not interesting to them. But they want to put this half an experience. Like your mother probably noticed, I can make you laugh by, making fart sounds, on your stomach.
Yeah.
Why won't you laugh when I actually put together jokes? But anyway, so you were 15 when you found Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, I think so. It was around I watched his half hour with my dad. It was the one where he did the bit about Nick Nolte being Batman. He's like, Jesus Christ. And it just it really got me.
That's funny, though. The what really got you was it happened to be a superhero joke.
Yeah, I mean, my mom, watched Seinfeld a lot. And I watched the later seasons with her. So, I was influenced some ways of that.
And Seinfeld loves Superman.
And we would just even, me and my mom would talk about comedy and stuff. But but poetry, I think I was just an angry, nerd kid in high school. And poetry was what I gravitated to. When I went to college, I studied to be an English teacher. That's what I was going to do with my life and do my poems on the side.
What kind of poems?
It's angry,
Do you remember any part of them?
I always had this one line that I remember, a poem called Confessions of a Bleeding Penis. And it was I gave love a second chance. I came of age and changed my pants. And
so it was always in there somewhere. Right.
There was it. And that was the thing. I would go to different coffee shops and stuff in South Florida. There was one called the Chocolate Moose. And that's the first place I did stand up. And what made me want to stop doing poetry and do stand up was I could make people laugh in the drive thru. And I thought if I could do that to people who have no hope at all, just imagine.
So it was first at work. What would you say to the drive thru? What would you?
I would make voices and stuff. I would be sarcastic. But I had bits.
But that's usually annoying. You know what I mean? Why was it funny when you were doing it? Why are you funny?
I mean, sometimes it wasn't funny to the customer. But it was funny to the employees. My job, I never wanted to be funny to the customer. I only wanted to make the people I was working with laugh.
What was one of the bigger, where would you lean in terms of
what's the talk? The microphone go to that they can't hear what you're saying anyway.
Right.
So the game that we would play would be that
I fuck up your order. A lot of people did that to me.
Yeah.
It's
a classic.
They're stealing your joke, Mike.
They're making up that the person ahead of you paid for your meal and that's right. How they start that.
No onions, but you gave them onions. That's my fucking bit. I did that. No, what I would do, so I was the drive-thru cash person. There's two windows at the drive-thru. And so when you get to the screen, you order. I'm the one taking your order.
Hope we blew someone's mind who went, two windows? How long has it been since I've been through a McDonald's drive-thru?
So then, you take their money also. So you're the first person that's hearing the customer, and you're the first person that's seeing the customer.
Did they sit you down and go, Mike, you're the face of the business?
Yeah, that's why I obscured it with a beard. So then there's the second window, and that's the presenter. That's the person that hands out the food.
Okay. We get the presentation. The presenter. The presenter.
I know.
It's so walk you through it.
You make rib, madam.
I present to you this bag.
The fillet of fish. So what I would do once I saw the person, and then they would drive from my window and get to the presenter's window, I would do voices. And I would talk like the person in the car. You know, so if it was a fat person, I'm so tired right now. I called really fat people in the cars car tours, like a centaur, because you can't see their feet. So they're just half person, half car.
But you're not saying this through the microphone.
No. Okay. No, I'm saying it through the headset. So, you know, there's two feeds, the feed that goes to the screen and then the one that just goes to the employees.
Okay. This is how, you know, those receipts end up on the news. Yeah. Fatty at table 9. Right. You know.
Yeah, you never messed up, did the wrong clicker. I'm a big old piece of shit.
It was table 9 and 10. It was a big fatty. You can't do this anymore. but anyway, yeah, so I would do those kind of voices and things like that. And the whole point would be if I could get the presenter to break in front of the customer.
I see.
If they'd start to laugh.
Boy, you were born. Yeah. But you developed a skill.
I was born in the roast battle. It shaped me.
How often would you get them to break?
Not a lot, because it could be a problem. But, you know, it's just a fun thing. And, I work usually 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. So it's, you know, that's that 6:30 in the morning breakfast shift when it's like one person every 2 minutes is a little, you know, it's not like once it's like slammed and you're busy, you can't do that stuff as much.
Wait, one person every 2 minutes is not a lot?
No.
What?
No, that's continuous line is a lot.
Wow, that sounds like a lot, but...
Like once it's like around like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and it's like packed, that's a lot.
Are customers the worst? Being a waiter, I noticed the cheaper the food, the worse the customer's attitude was. Do you know what I mean? Not like they're disgusted with the food. They're just like, I'm in a place where I can be an asshole. Whereas the food could be, you know, of okay quality, but if I'm charging you a lot of money, you behave.
Well, they're the worst there because one... You're not a person to them at first. You're just a voice. So, you know, and sometimes it is a technical thing, but the way that people just talk to that box is really rude. You know, there's like screaming at it, and often we can hear them clearly.
Well, I think somebody's really in there, and I'm like, hey!
And it's also universally, no matter what situation you're at in life, if you have the money to have a car and you know, go eat out at even a McDonald's. I know it's cheap, but still, if you have the money to do that, you're probably at the same level, if not better than the person that's working there.
Sure.
And so it's a universal thing that no matter what's happening in my life, I know I'm better than this person and I could treat them like crap.
McDonald's bringing us together. Yeah. Always.
But what it helped, you know, then when we go into the stand up was that I'd already been heckled and I'd already been like
spat at.
Yeah. And just treated like crappily by customers.
That's the real secret of stand up. Have you been treated like shit for like a decent amount of time?
What we will teach you.
Yes. And that's what McDonald's teaches you.
I mean, I know there's a little like, you know, prejudice in terms of like economics, but people that come from money that get in the stand up, it's a little harder for them to adjust. Because they're used to being in control or having, you know, people wait on them or...
And this is a service position again?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I got into it. And it's lucky, you know, having a mom that was in it. I always saw it not as this mythology. I think a lot of people that do it, you know, they see the best version of it when they're young. They see, like... You know, no one ever talks about like the guy that's just barely making a living. They see that Chris Rock special. They see Maria Bamford. They, you know, they see it at the highest level that it can possibly be in a packed theater, you know, with a warm up guy coming out at the beginning and being like, all right, everybody, you know,
maybe I'll perform in 4 different countries and they'll put it all together.
But beautiful camera work and all of that stuff. And so then that's what they think stand-up is.
And so what? So when you went to your first open mic, you were already on mic. You already kind of knew what to do with it. I know that sounds weird, but people don't know.
It helped for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Holding the mic.
Did you go by yourself?
I went with two friends, and I remember it was the Chocolate Mousse. It was the place I'd been doing poetry at for years, and there was a guy that I saw go up a few times, and he was so bad as a stand-up that I was like, I could do that.
Right.
Like, why am I doing this poetry thing? You know, like,
we're not supposed to thank those people, right? Because it feels like, because I have those people too, but you don't write their names on an album, right?
I mean, it's very much like, it's like, yeah, I could do this. And I remember I called my mom the night I went before, and just to like talk to her about it. And it was the best conversation we'd had, because we were just like, you know, I wasn't a comic yet or anything, but it felt like she was treating me like a peer. She was giving me advice. She was helping me out. And it was just a very nurturing thing, because I was born with like a motor skill disability and stuff, and, you know, picked on and things like that. She always like overly nurtured me and was protective. And so just to have her like tell me how tough it was going to be, and like, but making it like exciting like that. Oh, you know, you might get your ass kicked and things like that was awesome. Like, I was, you know, she was treating me like an equal, and that meant the world to me. And then I went up and I did 7 minutes, my first time at the Chocolate Mousse, and it was fine. I did like 5 minutes, and then I did a song called Kiss a Terrorist. I had this friend who was a guitarist that I'd met at the Chocolate Mousse, and I was like, let's just do like maybe I want to do just straight up stand up. Maybe I want to do songs too, because I'd watch Stephen Lynch's Comedy Central half hour.
What's the chorus?
It was, why don't you kiss a terrorist? It was something like, if you celebrate Hanukkah, you'll be off my Christmas list. It was like a parody of like Toby Keith type song.
Okay.
Oh no. If I knew you were a Jew, you'd be off my Christmas list. That's the name of it. And it's just like this, you know, like a parody redneck song.
You miss them? You miss the songs?
It was the only one I did. And, and it was funny. The waitress had like a Star of David necklace and all that. I mean, I'm half Jewish and everything, but she, you know, was like, that was offensive and this and that. And so that definitely like excited me even more. Like, oh, someone's affected by this. Like, I did poetry 7.5 years. People would sit on their fucking hands, not give a shit. And I'd be like, the rhythm of the anger in my heart does not want to start. And they wouldn't give a shit. And then I was up for 7 minutes doing stand up and someone was like, ugh. But that meant they were acknowledging me and that I was alive. And I was like, yeah, I think this is what I'm going to do.
Even if they're giving the middle finger, their hands are still out.
They're looking at you. Yeah.
That reminds me of Borat's Throw the Jew Down the Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It, where it's offensive, but it's...
I'm going to guess one had a different angle. That's what I'm going to guess.
How did the rest of the stand-up go?
It was decent, you know? I mean, like, I was proud. Like, when I look back at it, like, I had premises, you know? I had punchlines, like... And then, you know, and then it was exciting. Yeah. So like my two friends, Todd and Sheena, who were dating at the time, like they came out and the Chocolate Mousse was like a 45-minute walk from where I live. So they drove me that night, but there were times where I would walk there, and if I bombed, it was the saddest walk home.
Right.
It's a 45-minute just shame. March.
Do you remember the topics or your first line or anything?
My first line, which is a line that a lot of people do, but you know, I didn't know at the time, was...
How's it going, folks?
You know, like, I think I might be racist because when I go to the laundromat, I separate the whites from the colored. Okay. You know? I mean, everybody, like, you know, and then I did this whole...
I just want everybody to know that he hung his head in shame at the end of that joke.
And then I went into my don't be a Jew bit.
Yeah. And then I did, you know, I mean, that's the thing, like, it was a good amount of, like, race stuff, like, just edgy stuff. Like, a lot of comics start off shock comics because they just want a reaction.
Right.
And then, like, you hone it more after that. Like my second joke was about albinos. It's like I went to an all albino school. It was really rough. The water fountain had a sign that said pure whites only.
Okay.
You know? Oh my God.
And it was like, you know, they say once you go albino, you're horny like a rhino. And
wait, why?
Because it rhymes.
Exactly.
He's not embarrassed.
The poetry was still there.
Okay.
I did that. Oh, then my last joke. My last joke was they say laughter is the best medicine, which is why I went to a children's hospital last week and laughed at all of them.
And then you immediately bow.
And it's, you know, so I look back and it's like clearly, you know, they're offensive jokes. They're not the best jokes, but it's like their structure. Like sure. I'm giving myself some compliment. I'm like, yeah, it's, you know.
They got you ready for roasting.
A little bit, yeah. And then the next week I went back to the Chocolate Mousse. I did 16 minutes.
16.
Because I was so excited, you know, and when
the minutes are based by excitement.
Right.
Just do it until you stop being excited.
When you're starting and when you're arrogant, I also, you know, you have to understand I was performing where there were no other comedians. So I didn't have anything to influence, or I was just writing what I thought was funny and not being shaped in any way.
Right. No one could accuse you of stealing.
Yeah, even though some of the premises in hindsight, you know, like the laundry thing aren't original, but at the time, like, you know, every premise is available to you. The whole world is open.
But how does it get to, because you're excited, you can be up for 16. So you could have been up for 23?
Probably. And I wrote it all on a sheet. I typed out all of my jokes. I practiced them in the mirror. Oh, yeah. And then and I couldn't even have time to memorize all of them because there were so many. So I was just reading off a sheet of paper some of it. And I swayed back and forth. Like I filmed on like on a little video camera, like on a little cassette. And I would just like – I was so nervous that I would just rock back and forth like a Kokomo encore was happening at a Beach Boys concert.
Did it take you a second to know that was you and not somebody fucking with the camera?
Who is – they're sabotaging already.
Is this an unsteady cam?
Right. What about the first time that you that there was a shift in your career that you thought, okay, I can quit McDonald's. I have a ground to stand on. I'm a comic.
Well, I quit McDonald's. I mean, that's like, I guess I had like two answers for that. I'll tell you about why I left Florida for New York and then the first moment in New York where I was like, okay. So... you know, yeah, I started like November 2005 and I was doing like bringer shows and stuff like around like in the middle of 2006 and doing the open mics. And I was getting up like twice a week at best because it's Florida and I didn't drive. And so that guy, Todd, you know, and Sheena, like they would drive me to a lot of these places. I definitely thank them in my app.
Right.
Were they just fans of yours? I mean,
they're just friends, and they liked that I was doing it, and they supported it, and they were really awesome. It's a huge thing. I owe them a lot. And I realized that like I was doing well, but there was a part of me that was like, I think I'm doing too well for where I'm at. Like this doesn't seem right. This is odd to me. Right. And I was like, I think I need to go to New York. And I talked to my mom about it. And she was like, just, you know, and I was still in college, you know, it was about starting the student teaching, was about to become a teacher within like less than a year. And she said, you know, go for it, but just get a degree. So I got a degree in English in 2006, at the end in December. I quit McDonald's. I moved to New York.
By the way, when you tell McDonald's that you're going to quit,
I used to do a bit about this, and the bit was my boss was like, just remember Mackle. He always called me Mackle. He's like, just remember Mackle. You know, you always have a place here, and you can come back at any time. And I was like, and I looked him in the eyes, and I said, don't you ever fucking threaten me like that again.
Did you actually do that?
Not in real life, though, but that was the bit.
I picture him going, hey, I need to. I don't know how to break this to you. I can't work here anymore.
But yeah, Mike, I would hope so.
But he did say, you know, you're always welcome. And that was a great motivator. you know, things, you hear things like that. Like, if it doesn't work out, right. You're like, well, now it has to.
Right.
And so then, you know, was in New York for a few years, doing the open mics, doing any show I could, doing naked shows, doing gigs based off Craigslist, a lot of garbagey stuff, you know, some good stuff.
How were you making your living?
I wasn't. And I stocked restaurants at LaGuardia from like the middle of 2008 to like 2009 for about a year.
Even with an English degree, you didn't bother maybe getting, you're going to be working the same amount of hours anyway. You didn't want to be a teacher or like, what do you call it, an after school sort of thing, or
I didn't even tutoring. See that far ahead. Like I looked at it as like I was starting over, and I was like horribly poor those first few years. And you know, and like when I look back, like that time was my rock bottom. Like I was the guy that I would go to the diner even though I didn't have money, because I thought like someone would like buy me a bagel or something. And you know, now I look at that with like a lot of shame, but at the time I was like, I'm an artist, you know, this is noble. And it's like, I mean, I should have done something like that, but I was like, I'm just going to work the shittiest jobs that I guess a lot of it to me was, I didn't want to have to do anything where I had to think about it unless I was there.
Were you nervous that you'd cave? Like, okay, I'm a teacher. This isn't the worst. I'll just do this.
Yeah. I mean, after 4 months in New York, I thought about like, you know, because I would look at stuff on Craigslist all the time. I thought about teaching in Korea, like doing that for a year. Because I was getting my ass kicked.
Did you ever steal or run out on a tab or something like that?
I never ran out on a tab or anything. No. And I wasn't like that. I was, you know, I was like, I'm going to try to do this the right way. But it was just, you know, yeah, it was tough.
Did anyone get you that bagel when you went to the diner?
Sometimes, yeah.
No?
Yeah, I mean, like one of my best friends who like I saw today, Matt Morano, like he was that guy for me. And it's like now when I go over his place, I see like the newest generation of comics, and he's always nice to like the new comics and, you know, helps the ones that are struggling and stuff. And it's a really cool thing. You know, Rebecca at the Creek was one of those people, and, you know, she still does it all the time, like super generous.
Do you now try to pay it forward?
Yeah. I try to help people get jobs and things like that. There was a guy I gave my computer to because I was getting a new one.
You show up everywhere with a dozen donuts, a dozen bagels.
Yeah, guessing who the artists are and who aren't. Yeah. You skip people.
I'm showing up with a dozen donuts because I'm still chubbing up.
So when do you notice the switch? We're like, hey, this is it.
I mean, even comic. That didn't, you know, like it's like a gradual thing, but I think it was, you know.
Is it being paid or being on late night?
It was like little bits and pieces. I mean, I remember I gave myself an ultimatum. I said, I was 23 when I started. And I said that if I don't have $5,000 from this or get on TV by the age of 30, I'm done. I'm like, I'm not going to keep going.
An accumulated $5,000?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah. And
in 7 years, you want to make $5,000 in your career.
So, yeah, I did. I did New Faces in 2010. And even then, like,
that's the Montreal Festival.
Yeah. Right? And, you know, I was collecting unemployment from that old LaGuardia job and stuff like that. And, but not making a lot. I met my now wife, and, you know, she was taking care of me. You know, I was a little mooch with her in some ways. She would, like, you know, pay for dinners and stuff. And now we talk about it, and it's the sweetest story of, like, she's like, I always believed in you. And, and yeah, so 2010, I do that, but still it's not a lot. Like I was going to work at this, bagel place, and they wanted me to wear a hat, and I just started crying. It's like, I can't wear a hat again. This is, you know, this is oppression. And I walked out, and then, I know. And that was, and that moment happened 3 months after I taped John Oliver. I taped John Oliver on my birthday in 2011, on my 28th birthday. So it was like I met my ultimatum by 2 years. But, you know, that pays like $1,500 or whatever. It's nothing. Right. And then taxes and all that. And so I was like, fuck, like I'm gonna be on TV and wearing a hat. I was like, I can't do this, you know. And I just tried getting work, and you know, the thing airs. Oliver was like promoting me in press interviews, like, oh, we've got this guy that no one's ever seen before. And then he took me on the road with him, and that's what changed it. I did like 15, 20 dates with him, and that's like the moment I became a professional comic. Like, I owe a lot to that guy.
How does something like that work? I think the way people generally think about it is this is a big name, and now you're attaching yourself to a big name. So comedians take you more seriously, and the industry, I think, takes you more seriously. But even that, like, you were already on this TV show, that doesn't necessarily parlay it into a money-making career. How did that change your life?
Well, I mean, the validation and all that, for sure, it's huge. But on a more micro level, the checks you get for doing the spots is the thing that it's like, thank God, you know, like I'm cashing checks from stand-up. Like, this is the coolest thing in the world. I mean, and I got that spot. Like, I think Comedy Central had said no to me, and Brian was like, I'm gonna, like, Brian knew someone at the club that Oliver was at and was like, give him a 5-minute spot. And I knew the pressure of that spot. And, you know, it was basically, I was auditioning for it to him personally. And I had like one of the best sets of my life.
Wow.
Cause I knew I had to, you know.
Right. What advice would you give yourself? What do you wish you knew when you were coming up? Quit McDonald's after year two. Is there anything where you would go, oh, why didn't somebody tell Mike this?
I would say, like, don't be, you know, so angry. Like, don't be competitive. Like, just, you know, there's enough room for everybody.
How do you stay in that head? Because I watch people, we have a lot of people in the Keith and the Girls studio coming through, and we see them through various stages of their career, from the start to, like, they're already on a million things on TV and very well known. And what I notice is, as soon as somebody starts to have a bad attitude, and this is with us as well, it's with anybody in any career, as soon as they have a bad attitude, it's like it's such a, you know, woohoo kind of thing, but they manifest this terribleness. They create this wall around them where it's harder to even give them jobs because they're mad. So how do you stay not mad in desperate situations?
I mean, I haven't, you know, like, I'm working now. But when the Louis C.K. cartoon, you know, was canceled indefinitely, I didn't have a job for like a couple months. And it was just like, God, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? And, you know, and it sucked. And then it was like with crashing, they gave me a 1 week stay there. They're like, all right, so you're going to be here for just 1 week.
As a writer.
Yeah, as a writer. That's it. And I just like pitch my ass off like every day, like, but what about this? What about this? And what about this? And, you know, it was like, and I think that was that, you know, that same thing with Oliver and all of that stuff of like all that. Like, I think the most important thing, like, is you always have to keep working and trying, and that no matter what happens, like, we convince ourselves that we've graduated past a certain point. Well, now I'm here. I don't ever have to do this type of thing again. And I think that that's, like, very dangerous because it's, like, you always have to prove yourself, you know?
There's nothing that, you know, in certain parts of people's careers, there's, you know, I can't do open mics anymore. Maybe if you're a lawyer, you don't do this kind of paperwork after you get a certain credit, or if you now run the company or whatever. Is there anything that you don't want to go back to in terms of comedy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely do less open mics. Like, and there have been moments I'm like, I'm never going to pay to do comedy again. Like, because a lot of the open mics, no one ever talks about this. They charge money, you know? And so, if you're new and you're starting out, you're supposed to get up as much as you want, but it can be expensive. And look, some places,
what would you pay?
You know, so some places it's like you buy one drink, but if it's at a comedy club, that's a $5 drink.
Right.
Plus you should be tipping. But like, if you're really poor, then you sometimes aren't,
I mean, you're just talking, it's $5 a drink, but at McDonald's, that's what you take home for an hour, right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember the pit had free mics for years. Then it became $1. Now I think it's $3, but it might be $4. And it's like, if you do a lot, you know, some do $5 plus a drink. Uh-huh. And so then it's like, that's like $9-$10. And if you're doing 10 to 15 of those a week, it adds up.
And you're drinking Diet Coke, so it's even more of a shame.
But at places that are, charging a lot for it because, you know, they're bars and stuff.
Yeah, let's say I didn't drink and then I'm doing stand-up and they pay me in drink tickets.
Yeah.
No, I'm drinking.
Get the fuck out. I used to think about that. I was like, I don't drink at all. I'm getting this thing that is up to $10 in value, and I'm using the least of it.
But that's a secret. Yeah, don't be angry.
Yeah. So now you're still working on Crashing. You became a permanent writer, right?
For this season, yeah.
Yeah, and so in the summer you guys shoot, and you just told us that your schedule is 12 to 14-hour days.
Usually 12. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to exaggerate.
Yeah. There's been like 100, but it's usually 12. Yeah, sometimes 13. But they're long hours. Yeah, I mean that's normal. That is industry standard.
And it's really cool that you're here with us on your day off. That's great. We're also recording a Keith and the Girl show and our YouTube thing. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and then judging another roast battle later. Sure.
Yeah. Why not? So I was like, wow, I bet you have, you know, no time to do anything else. And he goes, yeah, nothing at all. Then he thinks for half a beat and goes, except I said yes to the Bruce Willis roast.
But a lot of it is like, I still remember what that, you know, not having anything. I mean, it's funny when I talk to people about doing the Naked show, they're like, I could never do that. Like that just seems humiliating or whatever. And I would be like, did you bark? Did you bring? Because those were way more degrading to me. Trying to like beg people to come to my show. Trying to be on the street saying, hey, I was like, I had two options before me. Pushing flyers in people's faces or taking my clothes off. I'm like, I'll take my clothes off. Fuck it.
That one seems like I'm in control.
And that one I know how to do. I don't know how to be approachable and get people to come to something.
At this point, it sounds way more professional and forward moving in your career. So, yeah. So that's the real lesson here. Get naked over push flyers.
That's right. Well, I've seen Mike, of course, perform stand-up many times. And
masterful, I think is the word.
Yeah, for all the... For all the celebrities that, you know, for all the TV credits that he has and how things are working out for him. And I think about those celebrities, his level or higher, that I'll see perform live, leaning against the wall, giving a shit, not trying, almost like, oh, I got to keep the exercise going, but they're not picking up any weights. My point is...
They're making their appearance at the gym.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But they're on their phone.
Go see me. I never make an appearance at the gym.
This is what I'm saying. Now, Mike gives
Shub
it...
up.
Mike gives it 1,000% and you can bring your pals and you won't be embarrassed. You know, how it's when you bring friends, it's on you. Mike's always excellent.
You see Mike Lawrence on a lineup and it's going to be okay.
Right. And then everybody else will up their game. Hopefully he's wearing clothes. Whatever you're into. The Mike Lawrence on Twitter, of course. Instagram is Mike Lawrence Comedy. The website where you can find everything is MikeLawrenceComedy.com. And, of course, you'll hear him on Keith and the Girl as well.
Yeah, so KeithandTheGirl.com for that. And, of course, if you are listening to this, you're listening to podcasts. So make sure you're subscribed to this show, My Opening Line, and our other show, Keith and the Girl.
Fish filet, 2 Big Macs. Just kidding.
PTSD.
And now the closing theme song. What you just heard was my opening line. Please subscribe and tell your friends. Go to myopeningline.com. Mm-hmm.